From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, and we give a warm welcome to Boar Den, correspondent for the Times of London. And our moderator is Paul Brandis, White House correspondent for USA Today and West Wing Reports.
Hello, thank you for joining us, and here are the issues. Democratic candidates meet for two nights of debate. President Trump criticizes one of America's biggest cities and the congressman who represents it. More trade tensions between the United States and China, and tensions between the U.S. and North Korea appear to be increasing. Also, the latest on Iran. Well, let's start with these debates here in the United States, where the fight for the Democratic nomination is well underway. There were two nights of debates in the city of Detroit, that is in the key state of Michigan. 10 people one night, 10 people the very next night, a very crowded Democratic field. And the front runner, ladies, remains Joe Biden. He, of course, the former vice president during the Obama era, but he's got some very stiff competition. Kimberly, your thoughts on these two nights of debates?
Well, it was interesting. Biden was on the second night of the debates, and you could tell that he was the front runner. He was facing attacks from all sides, particularly from Senator Kamala Harris, who really went at him. Even when other candidates directed their attacks at her, she sort of artfully would pivot to make those attacks about Biden in many cases. On night number one, you had Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, both senators as well, who are sort of the two lead candidates on the very, very progressive side of this extraordinarily large field. And they actually played pretty nicely with each other and seemed to avoid direct attacks, even though the moderators and other candidates tried to really amplify their differences. One of the big things about this round of debates that I think is crucial to keep in mind is that for many of these campaigns, it's their last opportunity to really stand out. The thresholds for getting onto that debate stage will get higher for the next round of debates coming up, and so all of these candidates were trying to pop.
And those are in September, right? Your thoughts?
I think the striking difference between the two nights was really notable. The first night, as Kimberly mentioned, it was sort of the moderate wing versus the lefties. The second night, it was the front runner versus everyone else. And one thing that really struck me was, despite the fact that clearly Mr. Biden is, you know, the best known, the front runner, he's up by a margin of anywhere between 5 to 10 points in the latest polling, the five being the lowest that he's seen since he's entered the race. The field to take the centrist position that he's really staked out for himself, it does seem quite wide open after those two nights of debates, because Mr. Biden, despite being so well known and despite being the front runner, as Kimberly said, is taking it from all sides. He's certainly did better in this debate than he did in the debate in June, where he seemed quite unpracticed and sort of didn't engage. But at the same time, he did sort of seem a bit stumbling. He was taking it from all sides, having to defend both his record during the Obama administration and his current platform in 2020, taking us forward, which is a difficult position to be in, having to do both of those
and
things.
And his record from his time in the Senate years and years ago.
Exactly. And it really gives you a sense of this question of, well, where is the party today? Is Joe Biden in step with the party? And is the energy really with the centrist sort of platform that he's pitching, or is it with the two left-wingers that we saw on the first night who, as we mentioned, were taking it from all sides because the energy is behind them?
Well, on that point, you watch these debates and sort of, you know, in my two cents here is that the danger is that some of these Democrats have moved, again, that's just my view, have moved so far to the left on certain issues that they're really out of the mainstream of what at least polls show most Americans think about issues like decriminalizing illegal immigrants, killing off private health insurance. That's what some of these folks on the far left want. But that's not what independent voters, again, what polling shows, in the middle. So the danger is that these folks are kind of arguing about these leftist issues. Are they alienating themselves from the bulk of American voters? And parcel to that, I think you mentioned this, Boer, they've been attacking the record of former President Obama. And it's worth a reminder that he's the only president, only Democratic president since Franklin Roosevelt to win two consecutive terms with a majority vote. And yet they're criticizing his record. They've really moved pretty far away from where he was, it seems.
Well, I think this is always the case in a primary campaign, that you see the candidates going quite far to the extreme, either to the right or to the left, for the primary to bring out those highly engaged primary voters, and then sort of tacking back to the center for the general election. And there's always this quest to strike the balance, to not go so far to one side or the other that you can't bring yourself back. So, especially in this crowded field, candidates really are doing what they can to stand out. But it's also worth noting, and it doesn't quite come across on the debate stage, is that very, very few of these policies that these candidates are laying out are policies that they can accomplish on their own as president. They do still need Congress, and in particular, the Senate, which still has a Republican majority. And many of the people on those debate stages, or on that single debate stage across two nights, are sort of frustrating the Democratic Party because they're on that stage instead of running for possibly competitive Senate seats in their own district, possibly endangering the ability of the Democrats to take back more of those Senate seats in 2020.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, Kimberly, you're exactly right. Right now, we're at the sort of go big or get real stage of the debate. But the real debate, which I think some of the candidates really tried to emphasize, is can you beat Donald Trump, whether that's in the White House or in the Senate? And that is the big question. So who knows? I mean, we'll have to see who Democrats select in the primary matches up with the mood of the country, as Paul, you were saying.
Well, moving on, meantime, President Trump has been attacking one city, Baltimore, just north of the White House. He says it's filled with crime and rodents and so forth. It's no coincidence, of course, that Baltimore is home to Congressman Elijah Cummings, whose congressional committee is investigating the president. Is this a winning issue for Mr. Trump?
It seems to really resonate with his base. And we saw with the attacks that he made against the four women of color members of the House, he was attacking them with the, go back to where you came from language. And that really appealed to some crowds at a rally. That is not all of President Trump's supporters, but he seems to be making this calculated decision, as does his presidential campaign, because you see this language perpetuated in some of their materials, that this is going to appeal to the base. I will give a couple of caveats here. We're sitting in Washington, D.C., which also has an extreme rat problem, and many, many people have come to the defense of the city of Baltimore, and Nancy Pelosi, who's originally from Baltimore, actually had quite the burn yesterday when she said that, you know, if he really thinks there's a problem in Baltimore, perhaps he should check with Jared Kushner, who she believes is a slum lord there, because Jared Kushner's family company owns many properties in Baltimore that have had some complaints about their quality.
Well, there have been more than complaints. There have been hundreds of citations, in fact, and pretty horrific stories from families there. So that's sort of the reality. And it's interesting also that Baltimore, that the president is singling out. I mean, every big city has problems that Baltimore has: crime and corruption, and yes, rodents and poverty, this kind of thing. But the president isn't really singling out other places.
And it's no coincidence that this is another member of Congress who's a person of color, and President Trump has consistently seemed more willing to levy some of his harshest criticism to members of Congress who are people of color, especially the ones who are, as you mentioned, Paul, investigating.
It's worth mentioning that Baltimore also has some lovely neighborhoods, a world-class university, a lively arts scene and culture, all the stuff. It's just like any other city in that regard, and yet that is the city that the president is singling out. There's an interesting article that I read a couple of days ago showing, in comparison, Baltimore is one city, but there are entire states that rank even worse than Baltimore on other similar categories like crime and pollution and poverty, dependence on food stamps, that kind of thing. So it would seem, Bohr, that the president's criticism is a little bit perhaps myopic here.
Yeah, and I don't think he's hiding it anyway. I mean, he had a rally in Cincinnati, Ohio last night where he said, you know, the city of Baltimore is really terrible, just like other Democratic-run cities. I'm not going to name any, but then proceeded to name other Democratic-run cities and states, you know, our beautiful California, which obviously is a very blue state, Los Angeles, Chicago, you know, the list goes on. You're absolutely right, Paul, that in many cases, not only are there other cities and states that have similar problems, but many other cities and states that receive just as much or even more federal assistance than places like Baltimore. And that was one of the things that Mr. Trump had been criticizing, claiming that, you know, a city like Baltimore, a Democratic-run state, is full of corruption, wastes billions of dollars, and gets lots of money from the federal government. When, if you look at the data, actually, that distribution of government funding and aid, you know, many red states get more than blue states, and that is not a fair comparison.
Well, let's pause for a short break. More Issues in the News in just a moment.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel, Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, Bohr Den, correspondent for the Times of London, and our moderator, Paul Brandis, White House correspondent for USA Today and West Wing Reports.
Welcome back. Trade talks between the United States and China have been underway for about 2 years now, and still no deal. President Trump has now acknowledged that he has so far been unable to get China to buy more goods from American farmers, and big differences remain on major issues like protection of intellectual property, cyber theft, and so forth. And the rhetoric appears to be getting worse, by the way, and I'll start with you, Bohr. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was on the road, I think, in Thailand, really ramping up the rhetoric against China, saying they're selfish and disrespectful of other nations' sovereignty. Didn't President Trump say that trade wars were easy to win?
He did. And it's funny because on the Chinese side, there's this insistence that they don't want to get into a trade war, but they're prepared to fight one. When the reality of it is, I don't think I'm exaggerating when I say that I think we're already in a bit of a trade war. Just yesterday, President Trump announced that he would put another $300 billion of tariffs on Chinese goods at 10%. That's already on top of another $250 billion that's being taxed at 25%. And he, you know, in his sort of quite normal way, insisted, oh, we're having a good dialogue, but President Xi is simply not moving fast enough, so I've got to put on these tariffs starting September 1st. Whatever the rhetoric that's flying back and forth, the reality on the ground is that there is, I think, a trade war, and that's certainly sending jitters through the market, as we saw yesterday.
Tariffs, of course, the president keeps saying that China is paying these tariffs, Kimberly, but of course economists and even consumers know otherwise. Tariffs are generally paid by the importer, and those costs are then passed along to the consumer, and we see that in the form of course, higher prices when we buy shoes and washing machines and these kind of things. What so far has been the impact of this tariff war on consumers?
Well, I mean, it's as you just said, tariffs are not being paid by China. Tariffs are being paid by American businesses and American consumers. So yes, we have seen prices go up in some of the sectors where the tariffs have actually fully taken effect. So you can see this more, for example, if you went to go and buy a washing machine any time in the last year, you will be paying significantly more for that. Also, one thing that's been very interesting that's come out in some of the reporting of myself and my colleagues is that many businesses, knowing that one of the items they carry is going to have a tariff, especially a steep one like a 10 or a 25% tariff, they're raising their prices across the board by less than the value of the tariff so that it doesn't seem like such a jump to consumers. So to go back to the example of a washing machine, the prices of washing machines didn't just go up. Washers and dryers went up so that they could sort of even out those hikes and make it not seem such a hit to this one item. The other thing is that it's slowing business investment. The uncertainty around the trade war is causing businesses to hold back on orders, on deliveries, on planning for the future. I was speaking with a group of distillers that was here in Washington, D.C., lobbying for some tax breaks, and they were saying that one business owner told me that he didn't want to buy a new still because he was really worried about whether or not the trade war was going to cause his business to do even worse. Even the Federal Reserve, which chose to cut interest rates by a quarter of a basis point this week, cited the trade war and the uncertainty around it as a risk to the ongoing expansion. And so this rate cut is basically an insurance policy. It's unusual for us to cut rates when the economy is doing well, right. But that trade uncertainty is even causing the Federal Reserve and other global central banks to think twice.
Where do you see this going, Bor?
Well, from a political standpoint, of course, the Chinese have to be very careful with their economy, but politically, it doesn't really do them that much good to tighten this up too soon. China has a very important role to play in the region and in U.S. politics. This next subject that we'll get to about the North Korean missile tests, China plays a great deal in the past, signaled the president, President Xi, that he is willing to help President Trump with negotiations in North Korea if President Trump is willing to give him something in return, and that would be on these trade issues that we talked about. The fact that China has a bit more influence in the region, more influence over North Korea, I think is quite clear given these missile tests that have happened this week. That gives the Chinese a perfect opportunity to say, look, you know, the North Koreans are making trouble. We've got this trade problem on our hands. Let's work something out. So I don't see it resolving itself anytime soon, despite the hit that both American consumers and Chinese consumers are having to take, because politically speaking, it just makes more sense to draw it out just a little bit longer. The Chinese have said that, you know, they're willing to fight any trade war, even though they say they don't want one. It's much easier to sort of, if you're not trying to win an election, like in China, Xi Jinping doesn't have to worry about that. It's much easier to sort of draw that out and not have to worry the way President Trump does here.
And for a long time, Kimberly, people have been talking about how there's a reasonable chance that President Trump could win election, but there's also a re-election. There's also a reasonable chance that he could be defeated next year. And some analysts are saying, well, the Chinese are kind of, you know, looking at the calendar and they're thinking that perhaps if Trump does not win in 2020, they could get a Democrat and they might have kind of an easier person to deal with. So the sense is maybe they're kind of dragging things out, seeing what happens in 2020. Is that a reasonable thought?
I mean, and if you're thinking about strategy in that way, the other point could be that she has every incentive to wait until closer to the election, knowing that President Trump would want a big deal and extract maximum concessions just before Election Day. There are many different ways that our political calendar tips our negotiating hand in a way that, as Boris said, it doesn't do that for the Chinese negotiators. And so President Trump has deployed trade and tariffs in a political way that we just haven't seen before. So all of this is new for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Quite interesting. I do want to touch upon in our remaining moments, and Bor, you just talked about North Korea. I want to talk for a couple of minutes about North Korea and also Iran. North Korea in the past week or so has conducted three different weapons tests, firing projectiles into the Sea of Japan. In other words, in the direction of Japan, not going all the way. These have been short-range weapons, not the kind of long-range weapons that get the United States so concerned. But even so, they're testing weapons now and firing things off. What are they up to?
Yeah, so there was, I think, the third missile test that North Koreans fired in the last week was conducted on Wednesday. This is happening ahead of a planned U.S.-South Korea military exercise later in the month. And we have seen in the past that whenever the U.S. and its allies are doing something North Korea is unhappy with, it sort of makes a fuss. And that's kind of the view that the Trump administration is going to take. Look, nothing to see here. This is what they do. But at the same time, it definitely sort of undermines Mr. Trump's argument that he's making progress with North Korea. As we know, talks have stalled. The promises that the North Koreans have supposedly made to him have not come to fruition. And it just does, it's not a good look when your pitch is that you can make a deal with the North Koreans. And for a while he had been saying, look, there haven't been any nuclear tests. Well, here we are back again. You know, about 11 months later, they're starting to rattle their sabers. And it really does draw into question the degree of influence this administration can claim in its negotiations.
They've had three meetings now, and each time the president has essentially gone to Kim. He went to Singapore once, for example, and just a month or so ago he actually crossed into North Korea, and they met in Vietnam. He's doing all the traveling here. The president is going, of the superpowers, going to the leader of the small impoverished countries. So from an imagery standpoint, you know, Trump is really kind of a bending over backwards here, but what does he have to show for it?
Well, I think another question is, what does Kim have to show for it? And what he has is this amazing PR campaign. He's showing himself on par with President Trump, the, you know, leader of America, the big enemy, the biggest, you know, country political player in the world. And so Trump doesn't have very much to show for it. And as Boris said, it is a bad look because this was early in his administration. One of his big points of, like, this is what I'm able to do that nobody else was able to do. And even when just recently he stepped over and, you know, into North Korea for a moment, these were big moments for him that were supposed to yield big results, and it just didn't happen.
Well, I do think one caveat to that, though, is I think on the world stage, you're both absolutely right. It doesn't get Trump very much. It's not a very good look. But if you're an American in Trump's base who doesn't pay too much attention to what's going on with foreign policy, from Mr. Trump's perspective, it isn't so much of a loss because he's just seen as, you know, going around the world, creating these picture moments. Look at all this fanfare surrounding my visit to Singapore or Vietnam or Helsinki or stepping into
So symbolism over substance.
Exactly. So okay. I think from that perspective, he probably doesn't see it as too much of a loss. From a global perspective, it's not a very big win, and it's, in fact, not a very good look.
All right, but we've got about a minute or two left, and I did want to get to Iran very briefly. The United States is now imposing sanctions on Iran's foreign minister, Javad Zarif, of course, and this has created widened the existing rift, I should say, between the United States and its European allies, who say, look, we want to keep the lines of communication with Tehran open. So what's that all about?
Yeah, absolutely. It is a very sticky situation between the U.S. and Iran and Europe and Iran. Just yesterday, Dominic Raab, the U.K.'s new foreign minister, announced that there would be absolutely no way that the Brits are going to do an exchange of, essentially hostage exchange. As some listeners might know, over the last month, a British tanker was seized in the Straits of Hormuz by the Iranians, and it seemed to be in retaliation for the Brits seizing an Iranian ship that they said was violating sanctions by shipping oil to Syria. There had been talk of trying to exchange those ships. That's now off the table. The U.S. is not helping the situation, as Mr. Trump has said that he wants to form sort of a patrol group, a militarized patrol group, to police the Straits of Hormuz. That puts the Europe and British allies, European allies, in a very sticky situation because they want to preserve the 5+1, now that though the U.S. is now out of it, deal with Iran. They want to open the lines of communications and keep the pressure, but also the diplomacy open. That's been made very difficult by the way that the U.S. has treated Iran, especially now with the sanctioning of Zarif.
And very quickly here, in about 30 seconds, this disconnect that I think you've just mentioned, you know, Trump has said that he's willing to meet the Iranians without preconditions. How can you talk to them when you're imposing sanctions on their foreign minister? Who would you talk to?
Right, exactly. And they've said very much that they're definitely not going to acquiesce to that. And the funny thing is, I think Zarif is a career diplomat would be the perfect person to represent this. A fluent English speaker, educated in America. He doesn't have any assets outside of Iran, he says. And in fact, the sanctions are a bit of a futile move, as he will be expected in New York coming up at the UN meetings. So it's not entirely clear what's been accomplished apart from upsetting the Iranians and sort of gesturing in a rather unfriendly way.
So you're referring to the UN General Assembly in September,
exactly.
Of course. Okay. We'll have to end it right there. Thanks to two of Washington's most prominent journalists, Kimberly Adams. She's Washington correspondent for Marketplace, and Boor Deng. She's the correspondent here in Washington for the Times of London. This program was produced by Kim Lewis, our engineer Jonah Cummings, and I'm Paul Brandis of USA Today and West Wing Reports. Thank you for joining us.